from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. After changing their story several times, Saudi officials are now calling the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi a murder, but still denying that it was ordered by powerful Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Coming up on Forum, we get the latest on the Khashoggi case, and also thousands of Central American migrants from a U.S.-bound caravan or crossing illegally into southern Mexico. They crossed over on Saturday. We'll talk about all that and the politics behind it with reporters from Time Magazine and Politico. Then we'll get a Bay Area response to the Trump administration's efforts to roll back federal protections for transgender people. That's all next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Upwards of 7,000 migrants from Honduras are making their way north, many headed to the United States after crossing the Mexican border over the weekend. The so-called migrant caravan is bringing renewed attention to conditions in Central America and drawing the ire of President Trump, who took to Twitter to speculate about, quote, unknown Middle Easterners amongst the migrants and to criticize Democrats and Mexico. And we're going to get the latest on that story in this Forum Hour. But first, the Saudi foreign minister yesterday called slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi's death a huge and grave mistake and referred to it as a murder for the first time. But he claimed that Saudi leaders were not involved. And in spite of the Saudi government's official stance, newly leaked footage appears to show a body double-dressed as Khashoggi's clothes after he was murdered. Turkish officials are identifying the body double as part of the 15-person Saudi team sent to Istanbul. Joining us now to help us make sense of all of this is Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter with Politico. Welcome, Josh.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Good to have Molly Ball with us as well. We welcome her, national political correspondent for Time and CNN political analyst. Welcome, Molly Ball.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And Josh Meyer, let me begin with you. This story just keeps changing, and it's really hard to pin down. The ground keeps changing under us in the whole narrative. But for a couple of weeks, the Saudis were insisting that there was nothing that happened, nothing untoward, that Khashoggi left the consulate. And now they're, of course, fessing up to some form of culpability and making some arrests and doing some intelligence work, but pretty much keeping MSB, Mohammed bin Salman, out of the picture. And certainly that's true about the president and Jared Kushner as well, isn't it?
It is. And so it appears that the Saudis are appealing to or are playing to an audience of one or two, meaning President Trump. I mean, I don't think anybody believes their consistently varying accounts. I don't think that they think that anybody's believing them either. I think what they're trying to do is just get past this as quickly as possible and then keep the relationship with the U.S. government going as it has in the past. There's some real problems here in terms of credibility, and there's a lot of unanswered questions even about their latest explanation of what happened.
You knew Khashoggi and knew him fairly well?
I did. I knew him not very, very well, but I would, every time I would go to Saudi Arabia or to the Gulf, I would see him. I think we met first in about 2002. He was always very, very intellectually curious. He was very interested in talking. I saw him during a counterterrorism conference that the Saudis had after some of their residential areas for expatriates were being attacked in 2004, I think. And he was very, very interested, very knowledgeable about the West, very progressive. I think he worked for one of the Saudi newspapers at the time. But, you know, he went to University of Indiana here in the United States. So he is not your typical Saudi journalist, I think.
And probably I actually interviewed him a number of years ago after 9/11 when he was working as a journalist in Riyadh, I believe it was. But I also kind of couldn't put together a man who sounded like he did getting in a fist fight with 18 people or so. I mean, that was essentially the story originally, kind of a really crazy and beyond credibility story, beyond plausibility story.
Right. I mean, it's just ludicrous. But, you know, remember that the Crown Prince himself was the one who said, you know, at the very outset of this, that nothing happened. They were very concerned that people were even taking it seriously. He said that he had left the consulate after a few minutes or 1 hour. in an interview with Bloomberg News, he said, "We have nothing to hide." And of course, they do have a lot to hide. Nobody has found the tapes yet, or they haven't released them. But what's
do we know there are tapes? I mean, Erdogan's saying there are tapes. I mean, that's credible because people in power do bug the embassies of those who are against them or who they see as people they need, other governments that they need to have information about. But there is, at this point, nothing really that has come forward from Turkey, has there?
Well, not publicly, but remember, there have been some U.S. intelligence officials who have confirmed, at least to some media organizations who have very good sources, that they are aware of the tapes and that they have listened to them. So one big question is, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo flew all the way over there to meet with the Saudis and meet with the Crown Prince. And then afterwards, he said they didn't want to talk about details. And so I didn't either. So the question is, why did he even go there? And did he listen to the tapes, or was he given an opportunity to? Did he even ask to hear them? And I'm fairly positive that at some point soon, some of that will leak out, some of the audio will leak out. The Saudis the more the Saudis deny it, the more the Turks are leaking details about this pretty much every day, including the body double.
Well, let's talk with you about this, Molly Ball, because it would seem at this point, I mean, Congress is responding, and Congress is responding not only people like Lindsey Graham, but also some of those on the president's team.
That's right. There's been a lot of pressure on the president to be more forceful on this issue, and his reluctance has been quite striking. And of course, it's not a mystery. Both the Trump family and Trump organization have had close ties to the Saudis, and then the United States has had a close alliance with the Saudis, particularly when it comes to Iran. So this is an extremely delicate diplomatic issue for any president. I think it's especially a test for Trump, both because of his personal entanglements and also because of the way it tests a foreign policy that is still coming into focus in a lot of ways. He makes a lot of speeches about America first. It's still not really clear what that means. He's maintained a lot of traditional alliances. He's cozied up to a lot of more brutal regimes while antagonizing allies of the United States. And so this is, Saudi was, the first country that he visited as president. And so this is a real test of whether there will be any repercussions. I think regimes all over the world are watching to see if there are any repercussions for this extremely overt act of brutality and violation of human rights against a dissident, against a journalist. All of the strands of, the sort of traditional American moral leadership in the world that Trump has been accused of wanting to unwind or ignore, they're all right here. And so, if the administration takes, as Josh was saying, the Saudis' explanation is so incredible as almost to be insulting, right? It's like they're thumbing their nose at the United States saying, ha ha, you believe that? Because it's so obviously false and they've so obviously already lied. And if there are tapes that come out, that will be, the administration so far has at least accepted the attempted distancing from the Crown Prince himself. And the question is, how long will that remain believable? And if it is not believable, will the administration go along with the rather flimsy rationales being peddled by the Saudis?
Well, Molly, what do you think about the argument that's being put forward, especially by those in opposition, President Trump, that his attitude toward journalists and journalism, calling journalists enemy of the people, saying that a guy who slammed a journalist from Politico was my kind of guy and who was actually convicted of that slamming, body slamming and punching, that this contributes to the picture and maybe makes whomever got this started from Saudi Arabia perhaps more comfortable with it?
It was the Guardian, the reporter.
I'm sorry, I said political.
Representative John Ford. Yeah, right. Top of mind. So on the one hand, regimes all over the world were suppressing dissent and murdering journalists long before Donald Trump came along. And the difference is that the United States has always, based on our First Amendment and our traditions of a free press, been very forceful in condemning those actions and been very forceful in trying to be a model, potentially an imperfect one, but trying to be the beacon of freedom to the world, trying to set that example of what it means to have civil rights and to have the right of free expression and supporting dissidents against oppressive regimes. And so it has been true that since Trump took office and as his attacks on the media have intensified, dictators all over the world have picked that up. Dictators all over the world are actually using the phrase fake news to condemn their opponents and in many cases to imprison or actually kill journalists, saying this is a very potent argument, if you can call it that, and it's one that is easy for regimes to violate that violate human rights to seize upon and say, see, Trump is right. This is all fake news, and therefore I'm justified in taking an action that they might, in fairness, have taken anyway.
Molly Ball is national political correspondent with Time and CNN political analyst. And as you pointed out, we've had a long alliance with Saudi and with the House of Saud, but there's a different cast of things now. I just wanted to mention this because there's a lot that's dependent on, in terms of opposition to Iran that the United States sees, and this is where Jared Kushner comes into the picture, I guess, and dealing with the Israelis and the Palestinians and working out some, or brokering some kind of peace, which they thought MSB would help them do. So there's a great deal at stake here, and I want to get into the responses from you, our listeners, and what you think about this, because Yemen is kind of lost in all of this, too, and that's a terrible ongoing tragedy with thousands and thousands of people being killed essentially by Saudi missiles and Saudi military efforts. But I want to actually cover what's going on with the caravan, too. Maya Averbach is a freelance reporter who writes for The New York Times, and she joins us from Tapuchla, Mexico. Maya, we have you on the line here? We don't have her. Okay, we're going to try to get her on the line. But let me shift to that with you, Molly Ball. I mean, this is also kind of a gift in many ways for President Trump. I mean, you know, he's certainly gone back to his campaign rhetoric about those coming off the, across the border, the dangers of those coming across the border, even at this time referring to unknown Middle Easterners and singling out the possibility of sending the military there, of cutting off aid and so forth. I mean, it's become a big political tool for him, hasn't it?
He certainly sees it that way. I mean, I think we'll see in the elections in a couple of weeks whether it actually was a net plus for Trump, given its potential to also excite the other side and the opponents of Trump who see the rhetoric that he's deploying, the attention that he's calling to this issue, the cruelty of policies like family separation, which is now back on the table. You know, that was a real low point for the administration in terms of many of their traditional allies even turning against that policy. So to the extent that voters are reminded of that, it may not be as helpful as he thought. But yes, to me, as a political reporter, these midterms are fascinating because they are our first real referendum on the attempted political realignment that Trump has tried to engineer. He has tried to reorient the Republican Party around cultural issues and issues of national identity, with immigration being top on that list, maybe tied with trade. And so, and of course, the Democratic Party in response has doubled down on its positions on those issues. And you do see congressional candidates all over the country. Very few of them are talking about the tax reform bill that they passed less than a year ago. A lot of them are talking about the supposed threat from MS-13 and from immigrants and so on. And so how this election turns out and how that referendum turns out is really going to tell us a lot about whether the American political axis now does run through these kinds of issues and whether and whether which side that's good for, frankly.
Well, Josh Meyer, the president said, consider it a referendum on me, bringing himself into the center, as he is so wont to do. And how do you think not only this caravan is going to affect the midterm elections, but also the Khashoggi saga as it continues?
Well, that's a good question, Michael. I think that, you know, President Trump says that it's about him, but I think you can pretty much assume that if it goes south, he's already been saying privately that it's not about him. So he's only going to take credit for it if it's successful. He's done that in the past, and he's essentially, you know, blamed people who lost either on the way they managed their campaign or the fact that they didn't hew closely enough to his policies and programs and so forth. So, you know, I don't know about that. I think the platform I think the Khashoggi issue is not going to resonate with people in the so-called flyover states, you know, between the West Coast and the East Coast, unfortunately, or the much bigger issue. I mean, the additional issue of what the Saudis are doing in Yemen and how much, how many billions of dollars in weapons we're sending them. But I do think the caravan issue is going to be part of an important theme here, which is, you know, the sort of post-truth campaigning style of Trump in which they're appealing to people's emotions instead of facts. I mean, what he said today in a tweet about how there's criminals and unknown Middle Easterners in the caravan, again, is just ludicrous, at least to people that, you know, follow these issues. I mean, they don't know the names of these people or even general details about them. So I don't know how they would know that they're unknown Middle Easterners. I don't know how they would know that they have criminal records. But I think people will tend to believe that because it's kind of scaring up this atmosphere and climate of fear among his base that has worked in the past. So we'll see.
Molly, hold on a second, because I think we do have Maya Averbach now, and she's a freelance reporter writing for The New York Times and joining us from Tapachula, Mexico. Maya Averbach, welcome to the program. Good to have you aboard here.
Thanks for having me.
I hope your phone holds out well, because I want to hear what you're seeing and what you're observing on the ground there. Can you give us a quick synopsis?
Sure. I'm in Tapachula, Mexico. It's city near the border. The vast majority of the caravan walked here over the course of 10 hours yesterday and then slept here overnight. A press conference just ended in which members of the group said that they had a lot of difficulties. They've been at times separated from members of their family and had to enter the state. There was a lot of distrust of the Mexican government's offers to give people different sorts of protections, and people vowed to keep going. And so that's where I'm right now.
Okay, and I very much appreciate you being with us. I'm going to have to let you go, though, because the connection is not as good as I'd like it to be. But let me go back to you, Molly Ball. You were going to make a comment before. Please proceed.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I think Josh is certainly right that foreign policy is not usually a big voting issue, and that it's probably not going to change a lot of people's minds out there in the heartland that this has occurred. But I do think it plays into one of the things that you do hear about from voters, which is concern about Trump's temperament. You do hear from voters, even Republican voters and a lot of independent voters, that they worry about the president's, not just the tweeting and the intemperate, you know, outbursts, but the fact that his governing style is fundamentally improvisational, and that you never know what to expect from him, and his diplomacy is sort of a blunt force instrument that lacks a lot of the subtle, careful calculations of, say, the previous administration. So to the extent that this episode reminds people of that concern about Trump, I think that could play a role.
One thing he's doing consistently, though, and this is obviously a lead into the midterms, is he's blaming the Democrats. He's almost doing that as much as he says no collusion. The Democrats are to blame, and they didn't let me put up a wall, and they voted against it, and so forth. Is this resonating out in the heartland, do you think?
Well, it's interesting that he simultaneously blames the Democrats for not letting him build the wall while also claiming that the wall is actually being built, which isn't really true. There's some fencing that's being reinforced. I think people know that the Republicans own what is happening. People know that the Republicans have the House and Senate. And so whether it's, conservatives who are annoyed that Obamacare wasn't repealed, or independents who look and see, for the most part, more gridlock, not to mention the Democrats who are really incredibly energized this year. I think it is hard to avoid what the president himself said, that this election is mainly a referendum on Trump and the Republican Party. You do have Democrats straining very hard to try to come up with a positive message, try to talk about the things that they would actually do if they were in charge. But the reason I think that gets sort of lost in the clamor is that people are seeing this mainly as an election about Trump and the Republicans.
There's also talk coming from Mike Pompeo, and let me go to you on this, Josh Meyer, about violence at the border and children being used as shields and so forth. And that doesn't, we didn't have a great connection, but from what I'm hearing, those who are At the scene, there's very little of that. I mean, there was some violence initially that was reported, but what do we know at this point?
Yeah, I don't buy that at all. I mean, I've been to the border, not recently, but I've done ride-alongs with Border Patrol there, and you know, and gone basically to the front line, even into Mexico and onto Indian tribal territory, which is straddles both countries. And that's just, it's just another canard. I don't think that that's the case at all. First of all, terrorists or people that are trying to sneak into the country for nefarious reasons, the last thing they're going to do is cloak themselves in some big unruly group of, you know, refugees or other people from Central America that are trying to sneak into the country. They're certainly not going to get in the middle of a caravan that has a lot of publicity around it and reporters following it. In terms of the people that are just trying to get into the country, you know, the sort of general people, I don't think that they're by nature a violent group of people. I think that they are legitimately people that are desperate to get out of whatever situation they're in El Salvador and other Honduras, countries like that. And, you know, that they're basically in a survival mode, and that's basically, you know, the extent of their problems. The bigger issue is whether or not the U.S. government can reach into those countries and try to eliminate the problems at the source, including MS-13. But there doesn't seem to be any appetite for that right now. It seems like people are not really interested in solving the problem. They're just interested, at least with regard to the Trump administration, of using it as an election issue.
Well, we're talking about the migration. We're also, of course, talking about the ongoing concern about the death, and it is now a murder from everybody's standpoint, of Jamal Khashoggi. But we'd like to hear from you, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on this and any question or comments you might have. We're talking with Molly Ball of Time and CNN and Josh Meyer of Political. And you, if you would care to join us now, you can. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We do want to hear your thoughts and any questions or concerns you have about particularly these two news stories. You may also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Coming up on a break here, but Molly Ball, here's Stanton, who says, organizing a large number of people like we are seeing in the caravan is a complicated process that requires a lot of resources. Who organized it? Could this be another Russian effort to influence the U.S. election in Trump's favor?
I have not seen any evidence to that effect, and that seems like a rather elaborate, not the style of the types of Russian campaigns that we've seen, which have focused more on cyber warfare and internet-based stuff. I mean, it strikes me as extremely unlikely. This is not the first one of these efforts. These migrant caravans have occurred for years and years, and they are in part organized by advocacy groups, although they do also rely on donations from people along the way who help the migrants as they make their way north. So it seems much more like a typical effort like that, only larger.
Another quick question to you, Josh Meyer, about the Khashoggi saga. Bill writes, in 2016, The Hill reported that Trump applied for 8 business licenses in Saudi Arabia during the campaign. Something smells other than the Saudi take on this. Quick response. Are we talking emoluments here, maybe? What do you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the Trump family and President Trump himself and the administration writ large are essentially transactional in nature when it comes to this sort of thing. So as we saw with China and Ivanka's licenses and copyrights, you know, that it does, it is a factor, even though it shouldn't be. So we have to be very careful of that. One thing that I would want to mention is also that the Iran part of this is a big wild card. If Iran attacks,
you're going to have to hold that thought. I'm sorry, Josh.
Yeah.
We're hitting,
okay,
hitting a curve here. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're politically reviewing the news, particularly two stories in the news, and looking at them not only politically, but in terms of the ongoing stories that are essentially unraveling and unveiling themselves here. And we have Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter from Politico, with us, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time and CNN political analyst. And we do want to hear from you. Let's first hear from Josh Meyer, though, who was finishing a thought before we went to that break. Josh?
Right. Well, I mean, the wild card in all of this has been the case for the last few administrations is Iran. I mean, they and Hezbollah, which is their proxy military fighting force and also terrorist organization. And if Hezbollah decides or Iran that they want to take out some U.S. targets, whether overseas or even in the United States, you're going to see the situation change very quickly politically. And that could be something that really backfires on President Trump. But, you know, one reason the Obama administration tried so hard to get an Iran deal, which I've written about in some ways very critically, was because they did realize that Iran is a very powerful force in the Middle East and beyond, and that in the current situation with Iran, Syria, and Russia all aligning together, if we basically alienate that nexus over there, we're going to be isolated and in a lot of trouble. So in some ways, that makes it all the more important for the Trump administration to be on good terms with the Saudis as a counterbalance to the Iranian efforts over there. But that also means that we're kind of stuck with the Saudis because we're both allied against the Iranians. So it's a very fluid situation. I know a lot of intelligence officials are very, very concerned that Iran might do something. Whatever the Trump administration does in terms of provoking them is not working and could backfire spectacularly.
Let me bring our callers on, and we begin with Sanjay. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I had a question. How much involvement did the U.S. have over the last 10, 15 years about the cause of the problems that are happening in South America, in Guatemala and El Salvador?
Let me go to you on that, Molly Ball. One can make the argument the United States has really been a very, shall we say, destructive force in Central America, which is why the economies have become so much in need of really American help in America. We've talked about this on the air, about a need maybe even for a Marshall Plan to get things economically back into some kind of a fashion where people don't want to flee the country.
Right. This is something that you hear people talking about. And it applies, I think, to the Syrian refugee crisis as well, that there are conflicts that the United States has been involved in that have helped to create all these refugees. And now you have an administration. It was already the case that the United States was quite stingy by world standards in terms of taking refugees. And under Trump, it has slowed to a trickle, and there are almost no refugees being taken in. And with regards to the caravan into South America, one of the things that we've seen Attorney General Sessions and Stephen Miller in the White House trying to do is narrow the path to asylum, which is the legal mechanism by which, you know, people fleeing violence in their home countries can apply to be taken in by the United States. They've tried to cut off virtually every avenue for that to happen and discourage it from happening and lower the quotas and so forth. And so even though it is a legal right of migrants to seek asylum in the United States, you saw with respect to the caravan, the administration trying to make people apply in Mexico, making the argument that, sure, you might be fleeing violence in Guatemala or Honduras, but why can't you just stay in Mexico? Why can't you seek asylum there and have that be where you stay? So these are obviously very complicated geopolitical equations. Previous administrations have tried to devote foreign aid and other resources to try to resolve some of these situations in South America. And you know, part of the reason that the level of immigration from Mexico is so low is that Mexico has largely become more stable and prosperous, which gives fewer people a reason to want to go north to the United States. But the Trump administration's approach to these things has not tended to emphasize that side of the equation.
Well, I should mention that President Trump spoke very favorably of Obrador and his actions in this whole caravan episode that's going on. But at the same time, he's talked to be threatening again to break treaty with not only Mexico, but Canada. And I should also mention, since we're talking about the news in general, and this is perhaps another segment for us, that the United States has withdrawn from a missile treaty with three other countries and claiming that Russia and China has essentially cheating. And that's a whole other story. I don't want to necessarily go there. Let's stay with what we're talking about. Let's go to Janet next. Janet, you're on.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Khashoggi, Jamal Khashoggi, was a Saudi national, and I can't remember the source, but apparently he has three children, all of whom are American citizens. Don't we owe something of accountability in their behalf, and are they being protected? It's not mentioned very much at
well,
all.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, and Josh, I want to go to you on this, because one of his sons I know is still in Saudi Arabia. He's been banned from traveling outside of the kingdom, and at this point, MBS actually called him and gave a condolence call to him.
Right. I mean, that's one of the surreal elements of this whole thing. And, you know, President Trump did question whether, you know, he was a U.S. citizen or a U.S. resident or as a way of downplaying this. But to me, that's not really the point. I mean, this is somebody who lived in the United States, had a family here, had gone to college here, was writing for The Washington Post. And by the way, I think that that one of the reasons the Saudis really misjudged this is that they didn't realize that his relationship to the Post and what a powerful news organization it is and how this would inflame journalists and the broader public. I think that they just didn't take that into account. But,
excuse me, Josh, I don't want to necessarily second guess the Saudis, but one could also assume that they thought he's a citizen of our country. He's coming into our embassy. That's our sovereign soil, and we can do with him what we want.
Right, which is what they've been doing for a long time. I mean, the U.S. government, and I've been covering this since before 9/11, the U.S. government has been coddling the Saudis, you know, through Democratic and Republican administrations. I mean, the term that they have us over a barrel in this case is quite literal in the sense that, you know, the oil that they provide. I mean, these days, that's not nearly as much of a case, and the Saudis don't have that leverage. But I think that they thought they could get away with it because they've always been allowed to. And whether or not Khashoggi was a U.S. citizen, to me, is less of a point. And I think that, you know, that the U.S. government should be standing up for him like they do other citizens and other residents of the United States. And that hasn't been the case here.
There's a very revelatory story that Maureen Dowd related in Sunday's New York Times. Some of the listeners may have seen it, and you both might have seen it. But she talked about a Saudi of high stature, a prince or something, sitting next to her and offering her a jewel box with a very valuable-looking jewel in it. And she said, "I'm a journalist. I can't accept this," and gave it back to him. And then in a few moments felt his hand on her knee, and he was trying to give it to her covertly under the table. I mean, it's an instructive story. It's kind of an amusing story, but also revelatory, as I said. Let me, in terms of how Saudis operate, they also operate murderously, as we've seen. Let me get another caller on here. Dan, that's you. Good morning.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My question is one of context. I'm unaware of this being either unprecedented or not. What is the history in terms of journalists, whether American residents or naturalized Americans, being killed by foreign nations, either friend or foe, or by the U.S. in the post-World War II era? Is this really a one-off, or has standards changed? If we're moving forward, are we trying to say that we can expect more of this sort of blasé response from an American led international system? These are a bunch of questions I don't know, and Google can't answer.
Well, there's a lot of questions embedded in your question, and let me go back to Molly Ball here. What comes to my mind immediately is Danny Pearl, of course. I mean, we've had our own problems with our journalists being under assault in other countries.
That's right, and multiple American journalists have been murdered by ISIS, and in every instance, they seemed to know what they were doing, which was to antagonize the United States as deeply as possible, and the United States has always responded in that vein. So it would not be this is a unique situation on multiple levels because those were not internal dissidents criticizing their home countries, criticizing their own regime. They were reporters for American news organizations. But it certainly is the case that the United States has seen fit to respond forcefully in those situations. And so the question remains, what level of response will this get? And will the administration, as Josh was saying, use the fact that this was not a typical reporter for an American news organization situation? Will they try to use that as some kind of excuse for not responding as forcefully?
Reading a comment from a listener named Ron who says, everyone should now finally remove the veil covering the brutality of Saudi Arabia and their Wahhabism with the global establishment of the madrasas in the 1980s. And Maureen Dowd's article, which I mentioned, Ron says, does give a good summary of their terrible history. Nathan asks, you stated that Yemen is being attacked with Saudi missiles. The U.S. is as much at fault for Yemen as the Saudis. Our foreign policies have created a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. When will peace be a priority for the U.S. government? Maybe when it becomes profitable. Some thoughts, Josh?
Well, I'm glad that he raised that issue because I think that that's something that's been journalists have been covering this, but it hasn't been getting a lot of attention. I mean, what the Saudis are doing in Yemen is a humanitarian crisis and a catastrophe, and the United States is essentially facilitating that by continuing to provide the Saudis with, you know, billions of dollars worth of weapons and advice, I believe some training. And, you know, I was at a conference last year for Arab journalists in Jordan, and that there were several dozen journalists from Yemen there, and we had several very long conversations. And what they're saying is that people are literally dropping dead, dying. The children are malnourished and stunted and so forth. And the extent of the catastrophe there is something that is almost unprecedented in our time.
It is presently the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, is it not?
Right, right. Yes, I mean, we're talking millions of people. And so the outcry, has been muted at best, I think. And that, you know, that's something that the U.S. Congress needs to accept some responsibility for, too. But, you know, the Trump administration has been very, again, transactional when it comes to dealing with these issues. I mean, Trump has literally, at least he's honest about it, he has said very publicly that he doesn't want to upend the relationship with the Saudis because they're giving us so much business in terms of buying our weapons. So the question is, you know, is
and
that
providing
even good
jobs,
for the American people?
And providing jobs, he said, too. Yeah.
Right, right.
But, so, sorry, go ahead, please.
No. So, I mean, I think that, you know, the American public, I hope, continues to be informed by good reporting on this, because it is as tragic as Khashoggi's death is. You know, this is something on a much broader scale, what's happening in Yemen, and it's happening in other countries, too, in terms of what the Saudis are doing and projecting power. If I can, just I would want to address the earlier question about journalists being killed. I mean, more journalists are killed every year than before. And I think that you have to separate who's being killed, you know, the American journalists that have been killed by ISIS and other terrorist groups from state-sponsored terrorists, state-sponsored killing of journalists. I mean, I was in Pakistan writing about the same people as Daniel Pearl when he was kidnapped and beheaded. But that was a terrorist organization. The Saudis and the Pakistanis and other countries like that are killing literally hundreds of their own journalists and getting away with it, partially because they are not American journalists or British journalists. And I think that that's a huge problem that needs to be aired much more thoroughly.
And Molly Ball, the Washington Post reported that there's going to be an investigation by the United Nations, that there's going to be an international meeting on this. Can you update us on that?
That's all the information that I have at this point. And I think, as Josh was saying earlier, we'll see what comes out of the evidence that the Turks have said that they have and that the American intelligence has said that they have. And then the question from there will be, what does the international community plan to do about it? What does the Trump administration plan to do about it? If this is what we think it is, and there's not much reason to suspect that it isn't, they are going to be forced to decide whether to hold the Saudis accountable in any way.
Quick question for you, Molly, though. You know, there's been complaints by people like Senator Corker that American intelligence has not been forthcoming. There are other complaints coming about Turkey, who is supposedly our ally in NATO, not being forthcoming. What do you make of that?
Well, we'll see. I mean, this is an investigation underway, so we're going to see if they are cooperative. I mean, the Turks have an axe to grind here as well against the Saudis, so they obviously have an interest in the way that they cast this and the way that they make this look. So it is going to be, whether it's the international investigation, the American investigation, this supposed investigation that the Saudis are doing, more information about this is inevitably going to come out, and we are going to have a clearer picture to inform decision-making.
We've been talking with Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time and CNN political analyst. And by the way, I would recommend that people who have been under the impression, as I have been, that 52% of white American women voted for Donald Trump read your new article in Time magazine, Molly, because you set the record straight. It's not a majority. It's actually a plurality of about 47%. Important article, and I congratulate you for that. And thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter with Politico. And Josh has been covering this for quite a while now. And hi, Marks, Josh. Thanks for joining us this morning. Good to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
We are going to shift gears now, because we're going to turn to another topic in the news. Over the weekend, the New York Times reported on a memo it obtained that shows that the Department of Health and Human Services is attempting to establish a legal definition of gender That narrowly defines it as biological and unchangeable, determined by genitalia at birth. The New York Times says this is, quote, the most drastic move yet in a government-wide effort to roll back recognition and protections of transgender people under federal civil rights law. What questions do you have? You can join the conversation now by calling toll-free 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum at kqed.org. And joining us to discuss this is Dominic Holden, political reporter for BuzzFeed. He follows LGBT issues, and welcome to the show. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the implications of this, I think, are what people immediately want to know. How do you see it, Dominic?
Well, I mean, this fits in line with what the Trump administration has done essentially from the first month in office, which is to roll back protections for transgender people. They have both changed their interpretations of Title VII under federal employment law and rolled back their interpretation of Title IX in education. It's important to recognize that this is a memo from last spring, according to the New York Times, that would weigh in on Title IX, that education law. And the Health Division is not the primary agency that enforces this and would promulgate a regulation. So right now we have a question about this memo. Is this essentially Roger Severino from HHS's Civil Rights Office, who came from the Heritage Foundation, exploring options of what he would like to see done with his political agenda? Or is there something more recent that represents a decision or some sort of action from the Trump administration? At this point, based on the time reporting, we don't have that. We essentially just have a representation of an agenda from the evangelical right.
But the transgender people who are excluded from being in the military would make us, I think, suspect that this would be definitely coming from the Trump administration. I mean, it's in a pattern of, for lack of a better word, pacifying the evangelicals. That's been their concern about gender bathrooms and all the rest of that.
Right. And that really gets to another key point, which is that although the Trump administration has attempted to roll back the rights of transgender Americans to serve in the military, they have so far failed to do so. In fact, the Pentagon currently, by policy, allows transgender people to serve. Meanwhile, the Labor Department enforces an executive order from President Obama in 2014 protecting the rights of transgender federal workers and contractors, and the EEOC actively fights for the rights of transgender Americans who are employed in the private sector. So we have a number of federal policies that do protect transgender people currently. So while the New York Times report suggested that this regulation could write transgender people out of existence in federal policy, at this point, we have not actually seen that. We have seen one memo from last spring that discusses that. Does it fit in with their political agenda? Absolutely. A transgender prisoner policy from earlier this year said that they would guide where they house transgender people based on what they referred to as their biological sex. But we don't know what the limitations would be in this particular case. Even if a regulation is created by HHS or the Education Department, which they could, we do not have a government-wide effort to erase transgender people. So we should put this in context.
Well, I'm glad you provided that context for us. But nevertheless, it seems to, in many ways, feed in with the impression that many political analysts have that the Trump administration has tried to essentially undo whatever the Obama administration did.
There should be no question that the Trump administration's agenda has been to repeal, diminish, and reverse the protections of LGBT people. They have taken extraordinary steps, weighing into private lawsuits that did not involve the government at all, to argue against LGBT rights and to roll back policies. What will be interesting to look for is what the government attempts to do in the form of regulations in the coming months. We are expecting a Title IX regulation concerning education, another one from HHS that concerns non-discrimination protections and healthcare. Both of these concern how we define the term sex. And in these regulations, we could see what they attempt to do, though it is key not just to look at their intent, but what they're able to actually accomplish housed within these agencies. And I would just add one other thing. The check and balance on the administration and its regulations ultimately is federal courts, which has found in the case of education and employment law again and again and again that prohibitions on sex discrimination do in fact cover transgender people. Obviously, the federal courts are currently being stacked with Trump administration appointees, the Supreme Court, most notably and recently. But at this point, the trend is going towards transgender protections under federal law, not the other way. And it's not clear that a regulation could reverse that trend.
We're talking about a Trump administration memo with Dominic Holden, a political reporter for BuzzFeed. He follows LGBT issues. And we're going to invite you to join us with the time remaining. You can do that by phone at 866-733-6786. That's a toll-free number. Again, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post your questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And before I go to calls and emails, Dominic, I'd like to ask you about Roger Severino, who you mentioned before from the Department of Health and Human Services. Doesn't he have some connections to the DeVos Foundation? And what are we to make of that?
Right. So the Heritage Foundation is one of the big think tanks in Washington, D.C. They have very critical views of LGBT rights. They essentially think that there should not be non-discrimination protections for LGBT people. And the DeVos Center at the Heritage Foundation works to advance those ideas, particularly in education. There should be, among transgender people and LGBT people, it is absolutely understandable that they are alarmed from this New York Times report. It suggests that genetic testing of some sort should be required before we can validate someone's gender identity and what sort of facilities they can use, how they're treated in education. And this is a runs the risk of potentially being tremendously invasive and scary.
Not only invasive and scary, but there's, I'm looking at a tweet from a listener. Sarah says, what about those babies who were born with indeterminate genitalia, which happens more often than most people think? How would their gender be determined? Good question.
It is hard to know how this could possibly work out if not based on an individual's gender identity, based on the fact that chromosomes and gender and a person's biological sex are difficult to determine. You can't really imagine a universe in which you have police officers outside of every bathroom, making sure who could go in or out of the restroom. It is absolutely a goal of the evangelical right that has stocked the administration with a number of its personnel from several organizations, including the Heritage Foundation, to advance this sort of agenda.
All right, Dominic, hold on, because we got a lot of callers who want to weigh in here, and our first caller is a transgender woman. Lauren, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My name's Lauren, and I have a question related to...
We somehow lost...
Title
IX. We're losing you, Lauren. I don't know if the connection's working here. Let me ask you to call back and go to another caller here. Let's get Chris on next. Chris, you're on.
Hi. I want to make this statement as respectfully as I can, but I wonder why that the biological concept of gender is so often put under the same umbrella as the social construct of gender. Your guest recently said that there's no way of determining the chromosome of a person. Yes, it is. It's called science. So why then are we using these different terms to talk about this problem, which is really a problem about the way that we deal with these social stratification effects?
Oh,
right.
Thank you for the question, Dominic Holden.
It is absolutely possible to test an individual's DNA, but we get into substantial questions about privacy, particularly when we're talking about our students in public schools. Are we going to subject students to DNA testing before they enter a restroom? Are we going to do this for federal employees or people in the private workforce? Are we going to patrol bathrooms to make sure that people are using facilities that match their chromosomes? The way that some system like this would be enforced raises substantial questions, and I think many people would find it to be not only invasive but impractical.
Well, you've got a number of substantial questions coming in from our listeners. Let's get another caller on board here. Soren, that's you. Good morning.
Hi. I'm a transgender man living in California, and my question is, how much would California's laws protect me if this were to become policy?
Talk about the state-federal difference here, can you, Dominic?
Right. So a lot of states allow for a person to bring a claim under state law. The Unruh Civil Rights Act of California does protect people on the basis of gender identity in employment and education. A number of local jurisdictions have those protections as well. So even if the federal government is not willing to intervene, there are still avenues for people to pursue their complaints. I think that there is a substantial question about what happens when, if the federal government were to say by regulation that an educational facility must use some sort of biological definition of someone's sex at birth in order to continue to receive federal funds, would the federal government attempt to take away federal money if they do not comply by these standards? That's not clear right now.
And it's not clear with marijuana even.
And I think that it's important that that we wait and see if there is a regulation and what it says specifically, rather than convince ourselves immediately that we know what the outcome is going to be.
All right, I want to get one last caller on here. Lauren, that's you. Quickly, if you could. Lauren?
Yes, hi.
Yeah,
I'm here now.
Go ahead.
My question is basically related to United States passports. I see you talk about the immutability of gender and how this relates to Title IX and Health and Human Services. But I was wondering, does this affect the State Department and the issuance of passports? For example, me as a trans woman having a passport that's now been officially changed, I have a birth certificate that says female everything. Would this result in a cascading effect where the government would suddenly say your passport is no longer valid?
Yeah,
now?
It's a good, important question. Let me go quickly to you on this, Dominic, if you could.
I think that it's important that even though the New York Times report portrayed this as the administration making an effort to erase trans people out of existence, HHS, through a regulation, does not have the power to do that. We need to look and see if the federal government adopts this position unilaterally or if it is adopted by any individual agencies and gauge what the actual final policy is. And remember, there are organizations out there like Lambda Legal and the ACLU that have made it very, very clear that they will challenge policies that they see as being discriminatory.
We got to leave it there, Dominic. Thank Absolutely. You so much for joining us, Dominic Holden of BuzzFeed. An hour of Forum ahead. Proposition 7 is up ahead. Stay tuned.